Thanks, Scott. Thanks for all of you being here. Of course, when I was preparing for this, I was going to prepare a very serious, somber lecture. And then I thought about all the people who were going to be here, and I knew that wouldn't work at all. So there was no sense in that. So let's have a good time here thinking about some wild ideas in the 21st century. Maybe some relationship to the meeting theme of synergy in science. A few scrambled words here on the first image show some of the things that Doc was involved in. Cryptomole humus and lots more really great terms about humus forms. Someplace in one of his papers there was symbiotrophy of lignophytes and fungi, so figure out what all that has to do with anything. Beavers. I'm not sure that any forest soils research in the 21st century has gotten to beavers. If it has, why? Oh, the closest thing was whole tree chipping. So when Paul and I were working on whole tree chipping in Michigan, at one time I found a beaver stump in the woods with a pile of chips at the base of it. And I took some of those chips and I took them to a meeting of the wood tech people who were working on chips. And I asked these folks, what do you think of the chip quality of these chips? And they said, oh, those are really good chips. Where'd you get those? And I said, they're from the original whole tree chipper. Right. So Scott has told you a bit about my background. I grew up in Iowa, spent time in Oregon, spent time poking around the Abel Tasman in New Zealand and up north in northern Arctic Sweden's digging deep for critters in the soil. And I spent a fair amount of time just sitting in the mountains, cooling my heels. Many of you know from having looked at the four soils listserv over the years that I'm rather intrigued by little critters. Intrigued and amused. I don't have any vast knowledge of any of these organisms or what they are, but these are some representations of the ways I spend some of my time when I'm out running or walking or hiking in the woods. So as Scott has said, Doc, and I refer to Wild as Doc because I got personally acquainted with him. If I hadn't been personally acquainted with him, he would have been Professor Wild. Anyway, Scott gave you some of his background. He was a contemporary with Aldo Leopold during his days at the University of Wisconsin, and Leopold, as many of you know, at least I hope you know, was a forester and one of the early people in wildlife ecology here in the U.S. and became a professor. And he was also a wonderful writer and essayist and wrote, he published a book. A book was published just after Leopold died fighting a grass fire on a neighbor's farm in Wisconsin in 1948. So Wild, both Wild and Leopold have been significant influences in my professional career, and they have had slightly different points of view. Doc, because of his engineering background, was analytical and engineering approach, but he was also dramatic. Dale Cole can tell you lots of things about his drama, including wandering around the soils department at Madison, playing his viola. He was a Renaissance man in lots of ways. Leopold had a little different view of things coming from the background of wildlife ecology. He had an early ecosystems view and a land view, and he evolved lots of thoughts about conservation of land. Scott alluded to the fact that Doc was interested in a whole variety of things and folks. I found just recently in his Forest Soils textbook in 1958 that he wrote, "Recent developments in the ranks of forest soils students have led to a significant number of men of talent contributing to forest soils." Well, Doc's idea isn't valid in the 21st century. We have among us, and not among us today, many women who have been very active and have contributed and continue to contribute to forest soil science. So I thought it really was important to sort of acknowledge those folks, along with acknowledging others. And lots of colleagues, some of whom are with us and some not. Well, I'll just make a few comments about some of Doc's ideas and try to make some links with these ideas to what's going on in the 21st century. And I think all of these topics, Forest Floors, O Horizons, EIEIO Horizons, as they're called today. I really like the Canadians sticking with L, F, and H. I really appreciate that. Along with Podzols and Bruna's M's. Doc was interested in all kinds of things. Rhizosphere processes, he may never have used the rhizosphere word, but he and his students worked on that. Nutrient supplies, Doc did numerous investigations of nutrition for both nursery plants. He did a lot of work in nurseries, he and his students, as well as nutrient evaluations for especially red pine plantations in Wisconsin, and was interested in a variety of things, including ideas of resilience and restoration. So to reflect Doc's poetic side, this is from a paper in Soil Science in 1951. I think Dan Binkley steered me to this. I guess I would have turned it up. If you go to Google Scholar and type in S.A. Wild, Forest Soils, you'll get a significant list of papers that he and his students put together on the technical side of things, but Doc also wrote this, as you can read. And so he was interested in thinking about soils and woven all through his textbook. If those of you who remember that or those of you who have looked at it know that there are little vignettes at the beginning of each chapter from a whole variety of classical literature and woven into the text on technical matters are Doc's poetic writing about soils. And here, I'll link this link to Bunyan-Leopold Round River. Refers not only to Paul Bunyan, the great mystical logger whose statue is up Nord there in Brainerd, along with Babe the Blue Ox, and also the link to Aldo Leopold's writings. So in relation to humus, I just recently communicated with Cindy Shaw, who lives and works near where Scott is, and Cindy reflected that maybe in recent times some people talking about humus forms have thought, well, that's not very practical, this classification system. But Cindy said that in the work that she's doing with CBM-CFS3, so it's what, carbon budget model for the CF? Thank you. They're using the ideas of humus forms in classifying the potential for carbon storage in a variety of forest stands. So these just depict a variety of jack pine stands after fires in the tar sands regions in northern Alberta, and showing that humus forms from one version to another really make a difference in the work in putting together the Canadian forest carbon models. So I noted some numerous advances in aspects of forest soil science since Doc's work. These are just representative of some of those. Soil solution sampling, which all of us have been involved in one way or another over the years, and I recalled and confirmed last night that Dale Cole did early work on tension lysimeters, adapting the soil physics silica plates to field work. And so there's been a lot of work beyond that with all kinds of soil solution samplers, including the zero tension lysimeters and so on. not necessarily related to Doc, but interesting in the 20th and 21st centuries. And I distinctly remember this, although not where I read it, is that the symbiont Frankia was identified as Frankia and as not a bacterium, but as an actinomycete. And best I could tell, it was done about 1978. One thing that I've become aware of, and we haven't heard too much about over the years here, is Doc's interest in restoration. And especially comes to my mind Jim Berger and his associates over the years who have done wonderful work on helping to restore mine spoils. Doc was interested in weeds and weeds as competitors, and of course Bob Powers and all you associates and others who were involved in the long-term site productivity studies have made significant observations about the fact that competing vegetation may be the most significant factor in limiting tree growth beyond impacts, whether it's compaction or forest floor removal. Weeds have been a big thing. Doc was interested in forest hydrology, drainage, and some of the poorly drained forest soils in northern Wisconsin. And I've been intrigued for a while that related to hydrology that Dale Johnson and associates in the Sierra Nevadas some time ago recognized that just trying to sample soil solutions down deep in sampling rainfall input was missing part of the cycle because there are these near subsurface flows that don't get taken into account a lot. So related to hydrology, Dale and others have advanced that. And then, although Doc, I suspect, didn't ever quantify uncertainty because he was probably never uncertain, Ruth and her colleagues work recently on quantifying uncertainty, trying to get at the boundaries of the whole truth have been important. Deep soils and deep roots, we know Earl Stone and Paul Kalis' paper from time ago, and in recent times, Dan Richter and Rob Harrison and Darlene and Jordan James and others have been working on the significance of deep roots. Doc was interested in the mineral contents of soils, and recently some Danish colleagues, Karsten Rowland Rasmussen and Ingeborg Kalisen and others, have done some interesting work on the significance of mineralogy of deep portions of the soil in relation to potential long-term sustained productivity of forests, deeper than I ever sampled and that most of us have ever sampled. Doc was especially interested in mycorrhizae and did a lot of early work on mycorrhizae, and I came across recently and was delighted to learn and then have Jonathan Leek be with us earlier in the week for our biological weathering symposium. He and his colleagues have done very interesting work on roles of mycorrhizae, not only in nutrient supply and mineral weathering, but in global carbon cycles, historic carbon cycles. Not to discount others' work on biomass and nutrient removals, but I've also been interested in David Paré's and his colleagues' documentation of nutrient contents of a variety of trees in Canada. And in my mind, that can be linked, interestingly, with information that's available through the soil, I call it the Soil Conservation, NRCS, right, website, and soil profile descriptions, where there are documentations of the mineralogy of some deep horizons. So a challenge is, and I've dodged this for several years, is to put together what we know about above-ground removals of nutrients with the standard evaluations of nutrient potential in the upper horizons and looking at deeper horizons and mineralogy, and I'll come back to that a little bit, as potential sources of helping to sustain long-term forest productivity. Well, to shift gears a little bit, as I mentioned, Leopold had an interesting take on landscapes and soils. Leopold was an avid hunter, and he cut down trees, and so in spite of the views of many ardent environmentalists, he wasn't at all a preservationist. But he did have a strong sense of humans' use of the land and the need for some land ethic, and he rather poetically wrote in one of his essays that land is not merely soil, it's a fountain of energy flowing through a circuit of soils, plants, and animals. So all these animals are parts of the forested ecosystems that forest-soils interactions are involved with. So Doc was pragmatic and poetic, and Leopold was philosophical and pragmatic. I've been interested in forest-soil relationships for a whole variety of reasons, including, as I like to say in Oregon, keeping those log trucks on the road. I'm really passionate about wilderness areas, but logging is an important part of our economy in Oregon, many places around the world, and none of us now or in the near future are going to get along without wood from the forest. So thinking about forest soils relationships, jumping around again, so my mind in preparing this is kind of like Doc's selection of topics for forest soils research. It's gone all over the place, but here you are. So I like to think about forests and soils as mosaics in the land. And this image showed up in our Planted Forest Symposium back in 1995. I'm sorry, I don't know to whom to attribute it, but some of you may know landscapes like this, where in the southeast there are these wonderful mosaics of pine plantations interspersed with, I assume, streamside and reserves for wildlife and corridors, potential corridors for wildlife movement around. In thinking about mosaics, this is one of my favorite slides. I call this, this is an image of Indiana landscape not far from Lafayette. So I call this my image of Bill McPhee's farm. I don't know that it's Bill's farm, but Bill was explaining to me about the intricacies of these kinds of landscapes and the fact that there's no great topographic difference in these mosaics, but they're historic from long periods of time. So in our work in the forest and in forest soils, we know that these mosaics exist out there, but they're really covered up by all those darn trees and shrubs and stuff. And so it's hard to really appreciate that. And this just depicts on a mile-by-mile scale the intricacies. And as we know, as we think about it, this same kind of pattern exists on a square meter scale or a square decimeter scale. And so we're out there, and we talked about this a bit the other day, sampling and trying to represent pieces of landscape stands and landscapes in our soils work and not necessarily capturing all of the variability that exists there. So another way that I like to think about soils in addition to these mosaics in the landscape is to think of scales of consideration from forest stands to watersheds to landscape. This is an image from a ridge in the Mackenzie River Valley, not far from Eugene, Oregon. And the slide was not badly exposed. That's just the way it is in Oregon. It's green down below and often gray up above. But anyway, this depicts in my mind the thinking about scales, zooming in and zooming out as I've thought about roots and rhizospheres and mineral weathering and thinking about that in relation to entire forested landscapes. Some place along the line, Tat provided me with this image of thinking about scales of forest stands from, and this depicts in the upper right-hand corner, soils map, a general soils map, I think of New Zealand, scaling up, scaling down, scaling up, to a closer look at the mosaic of soils and down to the stand scale. So again, thinking about scale is important in my thinking about forest soils, and I think that's a challenge for all of us because we're out there doing detailed work, digging in the soils, trying to define details of the soils and not necessarily scaling up and down. And another look at this is to think about what's going on in the rhizosphere, soil particles, soil aggregates in relation to pedons and in relation to larger landscapes. This is one of my heroic modeling efforts. This is as far as I ever got in modeling. Although I do have an ecosystem model that I'll show you here. But I like to, some time ago I decided to think about forest productivity from the bottom up, rather than from the top down. So usually when people talk about forest productivity, they're trees and maybe the soil is involved. So in thinking about the relationships of vegetation to forest floors to EIEIO horizons to mineral soil and all the functions of soils that provide sustenance for forests. This is the culmination of my modeling. And again, I like to think and have for a long time, like to think about soils in an ecosystem context with inputs, outputs, boundaries, processes, inputs of a whole variety of things, outputs of, at this time, biota and organic matter, but now outputs of services from forests, as we say. So we've got to consider all the values of forests. So, and amongst all this, of course, is the creepy crawlies down in the soil, and some of these images have been identified as to what's caused them, and the one in the lower right is not clear, and it's everything from, it's not ants, I think it's ground-dwelling bees, but it's not certain. I sent this an image like this to an entomology friend. I think I sent it out to everybody, and people speculated about it, and I sent it to an entomology friend, and he's a good guy, but he's a passionate soil animal guy. And he said, "Well, Jim, of course, everybody knows that's ground-dwelling bee, blah, blah, blah." I said, "Andy, everybody doesn't know that." And in fact, later on, I found one of these little mounds with ants crawling out of it. So I reminded Andy that, well, maybe it was ground-dwelling bees and maybe it wasn't. Well, recently, I sort of reactivated an interest in nutrients and tree root systems and nutrient mobilization combined with carbon storage and weathering. And in thinking about this, and I'll come back to the reason for that, I was reminded again and again of this part of an essay from Aldo Leopold's writings in the Sand County Almanac. And I know Dan Richter responded that he has used this, and many of you probably have. And I really like this essay, and it's worth reading. X had marked time in the limestone ledge since the Paleozoic seas covered the land. Time to an atom locked in a rock does not pass. The break came when a bur oak root nosed down a crack and began prying and sucking. In the flash of a century, the rock decayed, and X was pulled up and out into the world of living things. He helped build a flower, which became an acorn, which fattened a deer, which fed an Indian, all in a single year. From his birth in the Indian's bones, X joined again in chase and flight, feast and famine, hope and fear. He felt these things as changes in the little chemical pushes and pulls that tugged timelessly at every atom when the Indian took his leave of the prairie. X moldered briefly underground, only to embark on a second trip through the bloodstream of the land. Well, if we could define and explain forest biogeochemistry in a way that's better than this, why, it would be wonderful. But I think this is a great depiction of forest biogeochemistry. So this is not an oak probing into a limestone ledge, obviously. It's a, so Tasky telling me, this is a five-needled pine, what, a limber pine probably, on that rock in the High Sierras, where you and I were together one time, among others. And this is a place in, I think, in the Sequoia National Forest, where it's very clear that tree roots are nosing down into cracks of rocks and getting nutrition and water from places other than typical soils. And these two images, on the left, Guillermo Troncoso at a deeply weathered granitic soil near one of Bob Power's long-term productivity sites south of Yosemite. And on the right, Russell Strader in southern Oregon with his hand at a place where there was a fan of mycorrhizal roots on the surface of a rock fragment right down at that depth. So this is just a reminder again that something's going on there down deep, and it's reasonable to speculate that there's some nutrition that's derived from the rocks down there as well as some water. And this is a depiction of a significant root system in an old growth forest where there was a clear cut at the edge of this stand, and typical windstorm came along and the exposed edge tipped things over. So Russell Strader's stretch is a couple of meters, almost a couple of meters, so both in width and depth, sampling 15 centimeters or 20 centimeters of soil probably doesn't quite get the whole story in these landscapes. So all this came together in sort of a serendipitous way a couple of years ago, and I was challenged to provide some thinking about rhizospheres and mineral weathering and rhizospheres and deep roots. And I thought, well, if I'm going to respond to that challenge, I better find some friends and colleagues who know a lot more about this today than I did back in 1967 when we were worrying about mineral weathering and rhizospheres. So I knew Rob and Darlene well and got acquainted with Jeff since he's come to Oregon State. I knew Karsten from past times in Denmark, and he introduced me to Ingeborg, and I'd known Inger for a long time since she was a graduate student, and they worked together with a colleague in Norway on deep roots and mineral weathering. This is just interjected to suggest that we keep in mind the diversity of habitats that roots encounter as they go down into the soils, and this is an image from Peter Homan from an area on the west edge of the Olympic Peninsula, below the mountains in the flatter areas of the Olympic Peninsula. So Rob and colleagues and Jordan and others have looked at soil carbon at depth, and I'm sure that Rob has pointed this out before in thinking about soil carbon models and Rob's concern about depth of sampling. So the blue boxes show what's in the forest floor. Routine sampling, as is often done for a variety of reasons, captures, as indicated in the teal-colored boxes and the golden numbers, captures part of the story of soil carbon in the total mineral soil. But as Rob and Jordan and others have dug more deeply, it's very clear that there's a lot going on down in the soil that's not necessarily captured if samples are only so deep. And this is not quite the SOB slide that I'll show you in a minute. But this depicts the range of soils that our Nordic colleagues have worked with in thinking about mineralogy, minerals down deep in soils, and the relationship of those to potentially supplying nutrients. And also carbon. So the Nordic folks have looked at carbon, and again, this image depicts carbon in the units of kilograms per square meter with depth. And even though, of course, there's a great drop-off in most soils as you go down in terms of carbon contents, there's significant carbon down deeper. And if you're curious, I'll later try to explain to you what a nemoral forest is. Soil carbon profiles that Rob and others have put together in megagrams per hectare again show the variety of contents of carbon with depth in 22 forest soils from the Pacific Northwest. Rob had information from one of the soils in the Amazon. And the Nordic colleagues have looked at carbon contents in coarse and medium textured soils ranging from 20 megagrams to 110 megagrams, depending upon the soil. So there's a great variation there, as we would all suspect. Related to the carbon contents, Ingeborg and Karsten have worked recently on thinking about the mineralogy of soils down deep in the profile, and related this to a so-called base mineral index that was developed by Olof Tham, a Swedish forest soil scientist, the father of Carl Olof Tham, who recently passed on. But Olof Tham developed what he called a base mineral index in looking at the silt fractions of coarse soils and connecting the fact that the minerals that he called base minerals, the base-rich minerals, were potential nutrient suppliers, ultimate nutrient suppliers. And Tham found a way to separate these potentially nutrient-bearing minerals from others using heavy liquid separation. interestingly, the early heavy liquids they used were toxic, and I think versions of that work today use non-toxic chemicals. But anyway, there was interest in the Nordic forest soils for a long time, in the coarse textured soils, so-called base mineral index, an idea of thinking about what mineralogy is down there deep and how that might contribute to long-term productivity. Well, in putting together a presentation for a UFRO meeting here a year or so ago, and ultimately a manuscript, Ingeborg put together this view of weathering root systems and soil carbon as is linked in her mind's thinking about all of these aspects of weatherable minerals, acidity, or organic chelates, factors that influence forest soil carbon, with reference to some work that we did that resulted from my work with Garth Voigt in our first publication in Science back in 1967, where my little mineral flakes, my low-tech approach to a razor blade for splitting mineral flakes and looking at them, shaking them up, or exposing them to bread mold cultures in Erlenmeyer flasks and looking at things through a microscope, that's a far cry from the technology that exists today. But at least we got what we think were some indications of weathering of biotite in those days. If this pea-picking system allowed me to use PowerPoint in the speaker mode, where I could see my notes, I'd read the notes that said, this shows, obviously, phosphorus release and potassium release at various depths in relation to something. Parenthesis, this is an SOB slide, so have fun out there. And I don't expect you to know the details of these images, except to note the shapes and the variations of the shapes of the lines, which indicate that both phosphorus release and potassium release, at least in some soils, through sequential shaking, which simulate long-term weathering, vary with depth, and that with increasing depth in the soils and increasing intensity of potential weathering, there's a lot of nutrient supplying capacity deeper in the soils, as the lines show, if you sort of get beyond the SOB mindset to thinking about, there is significance of what's going on deep in the soils with weathering. So the point here is that deep mineralogy matters, whether it's calcite, feldspars, biotite, or other things. I hear a little buzz, which means it's time to quit talking here. And these, if I knew how to turn this off, I would. Maybe I'll just let it go. That's one of my technology limitations there. So Karsten and Ingeborg and others have published some interesting papers on this topic, and you can find those. We can find references to those. Well, all of that brought together some thinking of mine in a superficial way, and Karsten and Ingeborg and Rob and Jordan and others way more deeply, literally deeply digging and thinking about what's going on in the root systems, and it's not only in the top centimeters. And as we know, roots, tree roots, are getting access to some part of their sustenance from being in relatively strange places that we can't access and analyze. And I've always thought about, well, how can we possibly, maybe somebody has done this, analyzed what so-called soil or non-soil is down there in the fissures of these granitic rocks in the Sierras or other places in the landscape. So the fact that trees can grow in those kinds of places and others suggests to me that forests and soils have a significant system resilience in a whole variety of landscapes. There the image shows Bob Powers and Matt Bussey in a landscape that was significantly influenced by fumes from a smelter someplace in Northern California, and the erosion followed. And then trees were planted on it, and the trees seemed to grow all right. So, and without any major rehabilitation efforts, no spreading of urban waste on the landscape, no introduction of earthworms into the mine spoils just getting those trees on the land and letting them grow. And this image and others remind me that Leopold wrote, man-made changes are of a different order than evolutionary changes and have effects different than those that we might imagine. And so we talk about rehabbing things and human-caused changes. For example, clear-cutting, simulating fire in the Pacific Northwest forest because it removes the trees, that doesn't quite work because the changes from clear-cutting are different than simulating fire. Well, to try to sum up here, I think challenges for forest soils in the 21st century, for those of you still charging along out there digging however deeply you dig, or however deeply you can get your colleagues to dig, challenges, and I think the challenges really focus beyond the nitty-gritty to thinking about potentially sustainable management of forests. We were talking about this the other day about sustainability. And I've come to think that sustainability is, as I wrote some years ago, sustainability is a quest, not a certainty at all. But we need to pursue that. And in order to pursue that, I think it's useful to emulate the range of thinking that Doc Wilde and his colleagues did in their research back in the 40s and the 50s and the early 60s. It's also important to set our work in context of not only the forest soil system, but forest land uses, landscape, regional, and wider scales. Of course, we're confronted with global climate change. And an interesting thing to consider is, with all the detailed studies that are going on, have we been and are we now maybe at times, a phrase from someplace in Wisconsin, maybe from Doc, maybe from Emil Truog, are we swatting at gnats while being trampled to death by elephants? And so I urge you to try to work on the gnats, but don't forget the elephants. Keep things in a context of broad landscapes, land uses as depicted here in Switzerland, and recognize that by and large, as Leopold wrote back in the mid-40s, interestingly, we are remodeling the great cathedrals with a steam shovel, and we are proud of our yardage, and maybe we ought to reassess exactly how things are getting along. So the upshot, as Leopold has written, for Wild Ideas in the 21st Century and Leopold's ideas about land ethics and the fact that, sure enough, science does matter. We need to keep that in mind. But that a land ethic changes the role of we humans, as Leopold wrote it, from conquerors of the land community to members and citizens of it. So that's a interesting poetic view, but to me it resonates in thinking about what's going on with forest soils research. So the community of the land involves all these critters, from chickadees in northern Wisconsin to grizzly bears in Denali and bears eating some of Dale Cole's salmon in the British Columbia Isles, and wolves in Yellowstone. And also it's important to me to think that in these phrases, we're just borrowing the land. And we're borrowing it not just from the kids of white Anglo professors in North America, but from kids in China and in the Amazon and Brazil. The next seven generations, as has been said, are the important considerations in things that we do. So we have these wonderful forested landscapes as this in the Cascades, where the variations in the colors of this image seen through the haze of Oregon and forest fires from a place where Paul and I were together not too long ago. The mosaics there depict varieties of site potentials, but also the varieties of ownership in the vast forested landscapes of Oregon, from private to public to BLM to state. So forest soils work can help us understand what's going on here, but we hope can help us understand how we fit together in the larger context of our societies and the changes and challenges we have in the world. So that's it. Thank you.
We do have time for questions for Jim. Anyone?
So I had a list of potentially provocative topics, but I decided to censor it for fear of offending somebody or other who's done something. But Morris has a question someplace out there, I think, right?
It's sort of like ruminating, and I don't know how to start asking questions without offending everybody.
Well, what about the one that I prompted you to say? What about the one I prompted you to comment on? What do I think about open-top chambers? Right? Okay.
So, what do you think about
open-top chambers? Well, that's been very interesting. But what's it all mean, Mr. Natural? Where does that fit? And I don't mean to criticize things, because a lot of good science has come out of a lot of these things along the way. But sometimes it's useful to think about, well, what are the implications? And my sort of pragmatic, not romantic thinking about is, okay, how does that help us alter our understandings and concepts of managing forests to provide wood to keep those log trucks on the road so that the Sahara Club members can soak in their redwood hot tub decks in the hills of California. So just a little context.
So I have a question.
Oh, okay.
I have copies of Doc Wild's textbooks.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, a pre-publication copy. So we know how Doc Wild taught, you know, and you assumed his position at the University of Wisconsin after he retired. How are we doing on educating forest soils, people, you know, land managers, or how are we doing on educating land managers about forest soils? How the paradigm has changed, I think. With all due respect to Dick Fisher and Dan Binkley, their textbook is nothing like Doc Wild. So what do you think? How are we doing?
Well, I think there's certainly challenges out there, but with people like Eric and others actively involved in forest industry who've been nurtured, we hope, or stimulated or irritated by what's gone on in our conversations. With folks like that, heritage of Tom Terry and backing up to Gene Steinbrenner and others with Weyerhaeuser and Scott Holub along with Eric and other folks working in forest industries, I'm thinking that those folks have a broad perception of what's going on and working hard. And my perception is that in the Pacific Northwest, the industries have come under significant criticism over the years. But the pea-picking forests out there grow back like gangbusters and produce wood, not like yukes in Brazil, but produce significant volumes of wood and increasingly produce significant volumes of wood on lands that are, what are we into now, Scott, on Douglas fir lands? Third, fourth rotations there?
Third,
at least third, you know. And they were hammered, probably, if you will, in the early cutting in the 40s and the 50s, and those lands are still resilient. My thought about people's criticisms of what's going on in the watersheds in relation to salmon habitat, especially in the Coast Ranges of Oregon. You know, they say, oh my God, things are terrible. Well, if things were as terrible as they think they are, there wouldn't be any salmon in the streams at all. So things aren't that bad. That's not to excuse poor practices, but that's to say that systems are resilient, and then for me to recognize that practices of forestry have changed significantly since the early days, and people are cranking in the best knowledge that's available about forest-soil interaction. So I think the education is happening, maybe not everywhere, but I think it's going on.
Yep. I have a comment on that, just to maybe take it down a notch in terms of how people are educated in this country. One of the things that Weyerhaeuser and other companies try to do is interaction at the elementary, middle school, high school level and how important it is to educate them about industrial forest management, sustainability, and make them aware of how the forest actually works, and then take that to the teachers and educate them so that information educating one another. So it's really those people who are very influential on young minds, like your one of your last slides about the seventh generation. That's pretty important.
Yeah. I've gotten involved over the years since retirement with some outdoor education opportunities with junior high school kids especially, and in thinking about forestry and forest ecosystems in a whole variety of ways. And that's an opportunity, and I'm trusting that.
I have no idea.
I'm sorry.
Answer it.
Answer it. Yeah, I apologize. I'm trusting that some of the things that we try to talk with the kids about are spilling into the minds of the teachers also. And I'm convinced that that getting at, as somebody has, many people have pointed out, that probably, you know, getting to the kids is important, but one way to do that, maybe the most effective way to do that, is to try to get the thinking of the teachers, the mentors of those kids who are significantly influencing their minds, on the same page that we are, because we have the truth, or whatever an effective communication is about broadening their perceptions of in Oregon about forests. In the one picture I showed of the forested landscape there recently seen, the foreground was a clear cut. Well, I could have taken a Sahara Club image of that forested landscape and focused on the clear cut and said, this is what's going on in Oregon forestry. Oh, and I intentionally included that little niche of the clear cut in the bottom to say, look beyond that, and here are two or three generations of Douglas fir trees, hemlock trees, just growing like gangbusters. Pat, we had, and then we'll get look.
Pat. Well, I just wanted to thank you for a very thoughtful and poetic reminder, actually, of how resilient the forests are. I think your walk through the graphics there, certainly to me, is very humbling in the way in which many of us have spent years trying to figure out how forests grow, it's likely to be impacted by a variety of practices there. And I think that certainly you've given us a pretty thoughtful look at just how resilient forests really are. Trees are remarkable organisms, and clearly how we're going about trying to document the changes that are taking place in forest ecosystems and relate that to what's taking place in Stan Grove River's successive rotation is something we're already hungered at.
Yeah. Well, the kinds of things that you and your colleagues have done in New Zealand, Australian colleagues, with intensive plantation forestry, and people around the world, you folks who have worked with the eucalypts and other intensively managed plantations in Brazil and other places, know that it's possible to sustain things with significant energy inputs and resource inputs, but the systems are, well, at least a lot of the systems are resilient. I'm not sure that they all are, but a lot of them. So, Larry and then Dale, yeah.
Jim, you know, you made a comment about working with industry, but do you not see that, or do you not believe that maybe we've seen a real change in how we work with industry, and maybe we need a new approach to integrating with industry? Because there would be a time we come to this meeting, maybe 25 to 30 research foresters or research soil scientists from industry sitting in this room, and we'd be sharing our ideas directly. And it seems to me that that time has now shifted, and we're more working in isolation. I mean, there are exceptions, of course, with co-ops and things, but do you see that as affecting how and what we do for research in the future?
Yeah. I'm not nearly as closely in touch with industry, Larry, as you are or others, and so I think you and Eric and other folks, and Scott and other folks who work more closely with industry, and have better perceptions of that. I guess I'm optimistic and hopeful about it. But I do remember the days when we had, you know, there were more representatives of industry, and any presentation had to have at least one big green or red machine, right? Otherwise, it wasn't really appropriate in forests. So there are changes, but I'm hopeful, Larry. You know better than I. Dale.
One thing you didn't mention at all was fire.
Oh.
We're having a halfway unsuccessful attempt to reintroduce regular prescribed fire.
Right.
We're certainly having more and more increases in wildfire. So all these poetic management
Yeah. Fire is one of the notes that didn't get transcribed into the last version of the presentation, because I'm certainly aware of fire. You know, I'm aware of fire as you are from our burning landscapes in the Pacific Northwest, and for a lot of the forest in the whole West. And I've spent time in Colorado, and you know those landscapes with the lodgepole pine, and now beyond the lodgepole pine. It's not a matter of are those landscapes going to burn. It's just a matter of when they're going to burn and how intensively they're going to burn. So I think awareness of fire. In fact, I think there's a session this afternoon on fire and soils. I'm not sure what all that involves, but I'll stop by there. But that's a very good point, and you know, I mean, you're living right in the middle of that. I'm lucky to live in the edge of the Coast Range where we haven't had for decades significant fires, but every 6 years, what would it have been? 19, used to know these numbers, 35, 41, 48, 54, the famous Tillamook burn country. You know, it was just, and you've seen slides and images of that, was absolutely devastating. I mean, there was, you know, it was literally cooked away the mineral soil. And those landscapes now, given time, are supporting thriving stands of Douglas fir and hemlock and other trees. So the landscapes are resilient. And I guess our human timescale, our lifetime timescales, make us concerned and urgent about that. And we probably, you know, reasonably don't have the patience to think, well, and that's no good for the people in the towns in California west of the highway down there that just burned up. That's no solace. But over time, the systems at least are resilient. And there are other things that, of course, need to be done. But you're right, no matter what we do. Kurt?
You were talking about carbon sequestration and modeling carbon. I just wonder in the future if you see, you know, everybody's talking about climate change and carbon, and of course forestry would be a big part of the carbon credit market. Do you see that as something in the future that blends in with both harvesting and the forests?
So the question from Kurt Richardson from Duke, an old colleague from Michigan days, had to do with carbon credits in the future. So I've spent more time talking about that than I will about answering your question, because I don't know. I mean, I would think and I would hope, but I haven't had any really educated thinking about the role of carbon credits. But it seems to me that some way of accounting for those, what the economists called, in a secondary or third externalities of our life today, with, you know, carbon that's going into the atmosphere along with other potentially greenhouse gases. Even though methane is a more active greenhouse gas, I think maybe carbon and CO2 from forestry is more significant than the dairy cows in Wisconsin.
Well, the storage too, but
yeah. Yeah, thanks for the question, but your insight may be better educated than mine at this point.
Any other questions for Jim? If not, I have a teaching to admit.
First of all, actually, I would like to thank you for coming to this session. I'm really pleased that we have such a large crowd in the audience. And secondly, to thank Jim for allowing me to use part of the endowment fund for the Watt lectureship to order these drinks and food. And we do have access to this room until 1 o'clock, so I would encourage you to use up all the food and drinks and mingle with Jim, so we still have an hour. And number three is also to thank the donors who, people who will be hand this, that we got this endowment set up and supporting this lectureship. And number four, last but not the least, is to thank Jim for this really interesting presentation. And for that, I have a plaque to present to Jim. The Watt 2015 Distinguished Lectureship on Forest Soils, awarded by Forest Range and Wetland Soils Division of the Soil Science Society of America to Jim Boyd. So, Jim.
Thanks, Scott.